The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Premier League, Liverpool inch past Leicester at the top. Is Trent Alexander-Arnold just the best right-back or even the best footballer in the world? Elsewhere, Chelsea lose at home again. Maybe Wilson was right. Jordan Ayew turns into Pele for 5 minutes. Newcastle let Manchester United score 4. And there's a win for Ancelotti and a draw for Arteta in their first games. While Spurs come back to beat Brighton. Fitbar Corner returns, thank goodness. We'll round up the Football League as the top two in the Championship draw and the January rumour mill continues. We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Simon Burnton. Mark says, did Simon wear the bear suit for Christmas?
Yeah, no, it's winter time and the bear suit's in hibernation.
Okay. For newer listeners, do you often wear a bear suit?
No, I do own a bear suit, which I bought for my son's birthday party when he was about, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4. He's now 10. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it back then.
Yeah.
And not since. But some people remember stuff.
But whenever you do a clothes audit, you look at the bear suit and think, you never know. Staying. The day will come. When we do a live show, would you come in the bear suit?
Yeah, I could bring the bear suit.
Oh, that's tremendous. Jim asks, is Barry going to start or are you going to sub him in late to ease him back? And the pod addict says, how much did Barry not miss being on the pod?
I didn't miss it at all, I have to say. But I am glad to be back, and I had a lovely time in India. Travelling around, bit of an ordeal, you know.
Sitting in one place.
Bit too busy for me. Sitting in one place, drinking and eating a lot, going in the sea occasionally. Very pleasant.
Excellent.
So, it was a nice break.
Well, you look exactly the same.
Yeah, I don't even have a tan.
No. Hey, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
How are you?
I've got a cold, feel terrible.
Ah, can you make it through for the whole pod?
Well, we'll see, but, hopefully.
There was a radio show where Barry was so ill and you came to do a half-hour slot and ended up doing the whole show.
That's true, yeah. got paid just the same. So, yeah, you do owe me.
Let's start the King Power, shall we? Leicester 0, Liverpool 4. Liverpool have taken 79 from the last possible 81 points. They've got the same number of points as Arsenal and Manchester United combined, having with the game in hand as well. Paul says, how should the Premier League try to market this title race? Jonathan?
Well, people really like those sort of open top bus processions, don't they? So that's kind of the next 20 games, that's what this is. And after 30 years, I guess Liverpool probably will enjoy that.
So do you think Liverpool should start going to games on an open top bus?
Yeah, why not? Maybe play 8 men from the start. I don't know. I mean, I guess they could slip up still. The pressure of those 30 years might start to kind of drag at them. They could get an injury. But, I mean, the thing is, you need somebody to challenge them. And I don't think, Leicester, we've seen the last two games, are good but not that good. City without Laporte, defensively, aren't good enough. So I think, it's over. The title's over. They've won it. And well done. They were brilliant yesterday.
They were superb, weren't they, Barry?
Well, they blew Leicester away. Trent Alexander-Arnold was a standout player. I did the minute by minute, and I just constantly typing his name because he was so involved. And obviously, it's quite a long name to have to type repeatedly when you're up against the clock. But he was absolutely sensational. And there were a lot of good performances in this side. Difficult to think of anyone who played badly. Sadio Mane missed a couple of chances you would normally expect him to put away in his sleep. Jordan Henderson was excellent. Andrew Robertson was excellent. The two centre-backs were excellent. Alisson didn't really have much to do, but Alexander-Arnold was just incredible. Cross after cross after cross he was putting in, his cross-field passing, which teams find so difficult to deal with. His was exceptional, every one inch perfect, and then he was far from alone among Liverpool players playing those difficult to defend against cross field passes. He had 2 assists, scored a goal, and you could say he won the penalty as well because it was his brilliant corner that Soinsu handled. I don't think it should have been a penalty myself, but Kasper Schmeichel was very angry afterwards. He sort of said that was the turning point of the game, and he's delusional if he thinks that, but he said we were still in the game until the ref tried to be a hero, and I'm going, yeah, you're reaching there, Kasper, but I suppose technically he's correct because they were only goal down. But a brilliant performance by Liverpool against the team that, on going by the league table, are their main rivals, and they will win the title, because even if they do slip up, like Johnson says, no one is good enough to catch them and take advantage.
I think the point you made about Jordan Henderson is, I mean, obviously Trent Alexander-Arnold was the outstanding player yesterday, but Henderson, you know, last season we thought, oh, moving to the right of midfield and playing that more advanced role, that's actually what he's really, really, really good at. And then when Fabinho got injured last month, we sort of thought, oh, well, maybe this is a problem for Liverpool. But since Henderson moved into the, you know, into that deep lying midfield role, I think he's played five times there. He's kept four clean sheets, letting one goal in the other game. So actually been defensively better with Henderson there. His passing yesterday, he hit 11 long balls, 10 of them accurate, which is a ridiculous proportion. And he completed 93% of his passes, which is more than any other player who started the game. So you think of him as just being this sort of incredibly enthusiastic, driven, motivated player who kind of does everything by work rate and effort. But he's turned into some sort of weird side Xavi.
In the paper yesterday, in the Guardian did the player of the decade for each side, and Liverpool's was Luis Suarez. I think Henderson, Simon, could feel slightly disappointed not to get that.
I mean, yeah, it was a strange list full of odd choices made by my colleagues.
hang on, has the Guardian gone clickbait? Is that what's happened?
No, I mean, I chose the Watford player. That was the easiest decision anyone will ever have to make. Troy Deeney joined in the summer of 2010, and he's been the captain for most of the time since. Easy peasy. But some of them involve debate and discussion, and a couple of them were, I think, the result of some strange debates.
Do you think when he lifts the Premier League trophy, and he's already lifted the Club World Cup trophy and the Champions League trophy at the end of last season, this will prey on Jordan Henderson's mind not being included in the Guardian list?
Well, as we've established this month, awards don't matter anymore.
Well, yes,
Barry.
I meant to talk to you about that. I turned my back for 10 minutes.
Tom says, who has the better right foot, Alexander-Arnold or Kevin De Bruyne? What do you reckon, Simon?
Well, I reckon that the debate is ludicrous and can only lead to underestimating one or other of two phenomenal players.
But like, whose right foot would you rather have? If I was to saw off your leg and attach one of them, which would you rather?
God, what I would do to have either of those right foot. I'd have one on each leg. I'd cope with the lack of a left.
Who's taller? Is Trent...
Well, because you don't want to have a limb.
You don't want to be like
Kaiser Soze.
Yeah. I'd ideally like the one that's the same length as my left leg.
Elliot says, which goal was better, Trent Alexander-Arnold versus Leicester or Carlos Alberto versus Italy 1970? I think he was going a bit far, but...
Well, no, they both have an element of the opposition's given up.
Yeah, they do. But they have an element of a fullback sprinting onto a ball and hammering it into the corner.
And smashing it perfectly into the corner, yeah.
But how much has the role of a fullback changed? Because Alberto there in 1970 is attacking, and I don't know if that was a rarity then.
I mean, it was more of a rarity than it is today, but there's a very good book you could read on this.
Welcome back, Barry.
But I was about to say the interesting thing, I'm probably giving it too much credit. A mildly diverting thing is that left backs were traditionally much, much more attacking than right backs. So the first sort of three great attacking fullbacks were Nilton Santos of Brazil, Silvio Marcellini of Argentina, and Giacinto Facchetti of Italy and Inter. In Italy, that makes total sense because of the way that you had the skew in the catenaccio, that the right back was essentially right-sided centre-back, so you had the right wing dropping in, which meant the left back had to push forward to create width on the left. So that was a totally logical thing. But the only sort of logic as to why the left back would be more attacking in other structures is, it's a point Gianluca Vialli makes in his book, which is that he says for a long, long time the right back was the worst player on the pitch. Because if you were good at defending and right footed, you'd play at centre back. If you're good on the ball and right footed, you'd play on the right side of midfield. Left footed players were a bit rarer, so they kind of got left alone. So the right back was a bloke who wasn't good enough.
I love how it's like Sunday League football at that level.
It's like Carragher said, nobody wants to be Gary Neville.
But obviously, the last sort of 15, 20 years, that has changed, and the right back has become a hugely important attacking figure.
And nobody wants to be Gary Neville, but a lot of kids will want to be Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Watching Alexander-Arnold last night, if David Beckham were playing today, would he be a right back?
Well, that's a good question.
And maybe he's not quite quick enough. Mm. But in terms of the rest of his skill set, gets up and down, you know, great delivery of the ball, not necessarily great at beating a man.
Ari says, can you see Trent Alexander-Arnold moving to midfield as a deep line playmaker for England? And this is not the first person to ask this question, and I don't understand why.
That's applying the Gianluca Vialli logic. I'm not saying Vialli believes that now, but the logic of the teams he played in the 80s and 90s, that the right back was the worst player on the pitch, and therefore if you had a good player there, you should move him. Right back's a really important position. Like, leave a really, really good right back at right back. And England do have an issue at the back of midfield, and it may be that, you know, there's some sort of combination of circumstances where England are better with Wan-Bissaka at right back and Alexander Arnold in midfield, but that's a fudge because England don't have a particularly great holding midfield at the moment.
Right. True. Richard Jolly's tweet: James Milner scores on the 17th anniversary of his first Premier League goal. It was his first touch
against Sunderland.
It was a lovely camera angle, that, wasn't it, for the penalty, because it was like striker on the Amiga. You've seen it from behind the goal, but the way they angled it, it made the goal look absolutely enormous.
I think that angle makes it look more difficult to score.
Do you?
Yeah. Hmm. But it wasn't a very good penalty by his usual high standards, and, you know, to be fair, it was his first touch of the ball. But, if Kasper Schmeichel had stood his ground, I think he would have saved it quite comfortably.
I thought it was a quite a good penalty, because when you looked at the replay from behind him, it was so obvious that he was going to the right. And he can't put it that far to the left while making every bit of his movement and his body position, while telecasting that he's putting it to the right. He can't then put it that far to the left.
Yeah. And also, he always puts it into the bottom right-hand corner.
So. I like the fact he was telecasting, like he was Tony Gregg.
Alan says, what has Ben Chilwell done to deserve getting no help down the left in the last 2 weeks? First it was Mahrez and De Bruyne, and now Trent, 7-1, and poor Ben has had to watch most of it fly down his side of the pitch. Is this did Brendan Rodgers get this game wrong or not?
I mean, maybe, but Liverpool were really, really, really good. Maybe an issue with Leicester structure, but it's been really good up until the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks, so I wouldn't be too critical.
Maddison did nothing yesterday, though. He was obviously in a role he's not used to playing, but he was shockingly poor. How much of that was his own fault, I don't know, but yeah, his contribution was negligible.
Salah missed a one-on-one, which was a counter-attack from a Leicester corner, which was exactly, like, almost identically the same move as the one from which they took the lead against Watford a couple of weeks ago, in that the opposition had a corner, it was headed to the same position on the edge of the area, where someone hooked it over his shoulder to Mane on the left wing, who played it forward to Salah, who ran through and scored one and missed the other. And I think it's quite rare to see the same team do exactly the same move in two games so close
together. But Klopp practices this. Sure. It's part of his, you know, they have these series of set moves where everybody knows where the other one's going to, you know, where other players are going to move to, so you can play the pass that much quicker. So I think that's just evidence of what we knew.
And actually, what's interesting is every player that's come in has been, I thought Naby Keita was great yesterday, and you think about the worries with Liverpool if they miss certain players. Actually, they have had, even from the start of the season when Alisson was out, you know, they have coped with every single thing that's hit them, and it's not like they've had everyone to choose from every game.
That's true.
Thank you.
I think what's interesting about them is that they do have maybe not in midfield, but certainly the front three is pretty obvious, the back four is pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. So were one of the fullbacks to get injured, were Van Dijk to get injured, were one of those front three to get injured, maybe that is a bigger issue for them than it would be for a lot of teams. But I don't know. I mean, I'm scratching around trying to find reasons why the title race might be exciting and failing.
All right, let's go to meaningless mid-table football then. Manchester United 4, Newcastle 1. Nice tweet from my favourite tactics man, Michael Cox. An incredibly on-brand display from Solskjaer's Manchester United. Started the game playing a team below them in the table, so performed badly and went behind. That goal meant their opponents were now ahead of them in the live league table, and therefore they dutifully started playing well. Did Manchester
United... So hang on. I mean, you say he's your favourite. I wouldn't have picked this up, but, you know, if we're going to start playing silly little games, why, when United were 2-1 up, do they not start playing badly again?
Well, very good point. But the question is, how well did Manchester United play, or was this just Newcastle basically delivered them every single goal, as far as I could tell, Simon.
There were two Newcastle assists. And there was also, so Steve Bruce, talking about the game after it finished, basically said that Manchester United are so good at counter-attacking that once you fall behind to them, you can't attack. There's nothing you can do. Once you're losing, then accept defeat graciously and try to minimise the scoreline. If you fall behind and you attempt to equalise, the only possible result is conceding more goals. So don't attack. I mean, that is what he said. So the second half was just... they've got another game. Both teams have another game in a couple of days. They want to preserve energy. It was just a weird procession. Of course, Newcastle created a couple of goals for Manchester United. After initially, you know, things seemed to be going so perfectly for them, they scored the goal they needed.
Well, they had a very good chance before the goal as well.
They did, just before the goal.
Great, the Gale chance. So, yeah, you do think if they'd held that 1-0 and hadn't immediately given United an equaliser, what might happen?
Well, Dubravka could have done better for the first, I think.
Yeah, he could, I think.
Definitely, got two hands to it.
And Mason Greenwood, who is a really exciting prospect, Baz, I mean, he absolutely twatted that, didn't he? And it was such a shame it got a slight deflection, because we first see it, you think, it's the next Yeboah.
I don't think it's a shame. I mean, I was surprised. I genuinely taken aback when I saw it gone in, and I do like those ones that go in off the underside of the crossbar. But he really wellied it, and it was laser-like precision, and he is an exciting prospect.
Do we think, was it Matty Longstaff who was for the third goal? And it was a brilliant header, actually, from Rashford. And it's sort of not used to seeing him do a sort of towering header like that. But Longstaff gets an arm in the face in the move and lies down holding his face, because I'm convinced it was totally to try and con the ref. And if you watch it from one angle, you can just see him on the floor but looking up going, oh, bugger. Carried on. And then literally gets on and sprints. But it's too late. What does this mean, this result?
I guess that Manchester United's last game, they performed terribly and lost at Watford, and then they're 1-0 down at home to Newcastle, and there was interesting potential to test this, whatever Solskjaer's growing there, and Newcastle just gave it away.
And actually, when we're looking at what is exciting about the Premier League now, the race for the top four, or for fourth place specifically, is actually quite interesting, and Manchester United are 4 points off it, despite being as sort of average of Manchester United have been this season.
Yeah, see, I don't agree with your premise that the top four, race for the top four, is interesting particularly. So,
I mean, in the sense that we don't know who's going to get fourth, right?
I don't care. Okay. Like, I really don't.
Barry, a rich company will get even richer. It's brilliant. It's the essence of modern sport.
I thought you'd come back with a new Zen approach to all of this, Barry, but I don't care. I comes out 20 minutes in.
I've no tattoos. I don't have dreads. I don't have a piece of string around my wrist.
In fairness, not caring is pretty Zen.
That is, though, you're right.
I haven't done any yoga. Although the yoga hut was next to my hut.
Were you tempted to have a go?
No, because there was a lot of hardcore yoga practitioners there, and I would have been hopelessly out of my depth. But the yoga teacher was, I think, an American lady with a really annoying accent.
Okay.
And I would have thought...
Hello to our American listeners.
No, well, not all Americans have annoying accents, but she had a really, just an annoying voice, annoying accent. And I would have thought, the one thing you would need if you're a yoga teacher is a nice soothing voice, you know, not shrieking out instructions.
You have a soothing voice, Barry.
Yeah, well, maybe I could be a yoga instructor.
I'm
not quite supple enough.
It's like saying when you walked into the class and you were stood there on a bar stool with a pint of Carlsberg.
Kingfisher, mate.
Sit down, everybody. Anyway.
Right. Downward dog. Let's go.
So there's your Manchester United analysis. To Stamford Bridge, Chelsea 0, Southampton 2. Back-to-back away wins for Southampton. Chelsea lose back-to-back home games for the first time since 2011. The best performance since I arrived, said Ralph Hasenhüttl. You've already crowed about this on the WhatsApp group, Wilson.
I mean, crowing's... it's an ugly word.
It is. And it was an ugly crow.
Yeah. And you referred to yourself in the third person.
Yes, you did.
Well, Wilson often does that.
Well, Glendening doesn't like when Wilson does that.
Much like Lorraine Kelly, it's because the persona you see on here is not the real name.
Oh, I see.
For tax reasons.
Anyway, is this a justification that Chelsea are quite hard to work out, aren't they?
No, they...
Oh, okay.
They have massive defensive flaws, which means that fairly frequently they don't get what they should get out of games.
So should they have got something out of this game? Because actually, it looked to me like
Southampton.
True, but once the game began and you ignore...
Well, on the basis of what we saw over 90 minutes, they didn't deserve to get anything. They were beaten fair and square. Southampton, like other teams, elected to sit back, let them have the ball and try and find a way through these sort of closely packed lines, and they weren't able to do it once again. And they, you know, it's obviously Eden Hazard or someone might have been able to pick the lock with a crafty little through ball or run or whatever, but they don't have anyone who can do it at the moment.
But if you're a Chelsea fan, you look at how well they played at Spurs and you think, right, this is the real Chelsea.
Yeah, I mean, they did play really well at Spurs. I think the inexplicable thing is not how badly they played at home, but how well they played away at Tottenham.
Oh, okay.
They're so susceptible on the counter. I think that means that when they do come up against a packed defence, there must always be that doubt in their minds that if we lose the ball here, we're going to get, you know, they break, and there's a very, very good chance that it's a goal. And that must kind of inhibit the way they attack.
So that's
and presumably... To be fair, it was two very good goals that did for them yesterday.
Both counter-attacking goals, but very good goals, yeah.
So is that why Chelsea are better away from home than at home? And is that why, if you were playing Chelsea, you should sit back regardless of who you are?
Yeah, and there's a whole load of teams that's true for this season. I think it's still true of Wolves. It's definitely true of Manchester United. Newcastle are better playing on the break. You know, there's a whole load of kind of, you know, that sort of messy mid-table. One of the reasons it's so messy in mid-table and hard to kind of see any consistency is because they're all teams who want to sit deep and play on the counter.
Only Here for the Sport asks, are Southampton actually quite good, Simon?
Well, I think that yesterday's was a very good away performance. I think that they have a great deliverer of set pieces, and they have a good goal scorer in good form, and that is really, you're halfway there with just those two pieces of the jigsaw. So I think they're very decent.
Obafemi's goal, you're right, was beautiful. The move for Nathan Redmond's goal was sensational, and the first time you see it, you think that's the greatest goal I've ever seen, until Kante gets the assist, which is a real letdown. A bit like, you know, Greenwood's shot getting a deflection. It's such a shame that Armstrong couldn't have just dinked that over to Nathan Redmond. Jimmy says, today's most unnecessary away kit, Southampton. You're playing in dark grey against a team who play in blue on a dreary December day. Your home kit is red and white stripes, i.e. more visible, less of a clash. Then he starts swearing about it. What are you thinking? He says.
I mean, he's right.
He's absolutely
you know, right. I think they probably should be docked 3 goals for that, and therefore Chelsea won it 0-1.
Fair enough. Tottenham 2, Brighton 1. Did Tottenham deserve that, Barry?
They probably just about deserved the 3 points, but it wasn't a particularly good performance by them. It was ponderous. It was... it's a very slow move the ball, slowly move it from side to side instead of forward. But the introduction of Christian Eriksen, who didn't start but was brought on, made all the difference. And they deserve the win just about, but I think Brighton gifted it to them.
I thought that Brighton played excellently. I thought that away performance was very close to superb, that they made several changes to their team, maybe prioritising the next game where they're home to Crystal Palace and more winnable, but they actually played brilliantly. Their fullbacks in particular were excellent, and there were a couple of crucial moments. For one that stands out, that there was a Dele Alli foul that was really odd. It wasn't shown on Match of the Day, where it was Stevens who was headed a ball on the right flank, and Alli jumped into him. He couldn't win the ball. He, in fact, jumped after the ball had already gone. Stevens lands, having won the header, and is basically arsed in the face.
Yes, it was a buttock to the face.
It was a vicious buttocking that he received. And, I mean, it was out of control, and it was assault. And the referee didn't even book him. I thought that was really strange. Could easily have been a red card. Similarly, Winks was booked for once for a mistimed sliding challenge that, I mean, he didn't get any of the player. It was a bit weird. But
that was where their goal came
right,
from,
right, that's
actually,
where their goal came from. A foul on out on the right. He then did another mistimed sliding challenge. Also didn't touch the guy. But, I mean, there's no real consistency there.
No, and actually, Brighton had a player booked on the edge of the box for not a bad foul. And then I think it was, I forget, one of Duffy or Dunk was playing because the other one was ill. Sort of went in stud high on someone's calf and he didn't get booked. I thought Giovanni Lo Celso, you said Eriksen changed. I thought Lo Celso actually made a massive impact on this game. And,
yeah,
and,
I agree. Yeah.
And look, and it's hard to come into a game, isn't it? And he immediately just started, like you say, Barry, moving the ball forward and doing it quickly. And he looks like such a talent.
Well, there's a strange thing that Mourinho doesn't seem to fancy either him or Ndombele. And I guess with Lo Celso it might be because he's on loan with an option to buy at the end of the season. Mourinho's already thinking he's not my sort of player, so there's no point giving him pitch time because I don't want him and those wages would be better spent elsewhere. But the Ndombele thing I think is odd, the way he seems to have frozen him out already.
But he said, Jose said, Ndombele did not want to be selected for yesterday's game, and Jose said, I cannot say he's injured. I can say that yesterday he told me he was not feeling in condition to play the game, not based on injury but on fears of previous injuries that he has had since the start of the season. So I don't know.
Well, I would say that Mourinho could have said he was injured and it would have been much easier if he'd just said he was injured and that would have been the end of the discussion. I think it's really weird that he then he created the situation where Ndombele's commitment is now being questioned.
And when Ndombele was signed, you know, people who'd watched a lot of him said he was, this guy is an absolutely tremendous footballer and is still struggling to get in.
He's shown little flickers of it. I don't know. I sort of think he's shown enough in the first 3 or 4 months of the season that if you're a new manager coming in, he's somebody you try and get on side and get on board because you've just spent a huge amount of cash on him. And why would you not? He's young. He represents the future of Tottenham in the way that a lot of those players don't.
Jose has said in the past that he can tell within 10 minutes whether a player is any good or not. So maybe.
Well, that's really worked for him, hasn't it? With De Bruyne and Lukaku and Salah, all those people he wrote off quite rightly very quickly.
5 goals and 3 assists since Jose arrived for Dele Alli, and that finish was
brilliant.
Poetry.
Yeah, lovely finish.
The whole goal was fantastic. It was a long move. Again, Match of the Day, they only showed you half of it. They had the ball for ages, and it ended with a lovely crossfield pass and a fantastic first time finish. It was really a gorgeous goal.
Ian says Harry Kane's VAR offside, because footballers lean when they run are often sideways to start with. The armpit has bizarrely become the point most used for the offside plane. Wouldn't a grounded foot be more acceptable to everyone, less interpretation needed?
Well, Dale Johnson, ESPN's rules maven,
he got angry about this, didn't he? It wasn't an armpit.
It's not a literal armpit, it's a metonymic armpit.
But I think, as far as I could tell, Kane was actually further than an armpit offside.
I mean, once he saw the still, he just looked offside. Yeah. I didn't really have a problem with that. But.
No, I agree. Spurs will miss Harry Winks and Sissoko, which was their starting midfield for their trip to Norwich. Son's already suspended. My wife and I went for a nice walk on Christmas Day to St Paul's Cathedral down the South Bank. I saw two South Korean tourists in full Tottenham kit. They had every single bit of merchandise you could get from Tottenham: hat, scarf, gloves, kit, coat, everything. Presumably they'd come all this way to watch Heung-min Son play on Boxing Day.
That's unfortunate.
He was suspended. Jose, and there's been lots of talk about fixture congestion. Jose's quotes afterwards were,
maybe they were just cold.
That's possible. And the first shop they saw was the Tottenham Hotspur club shop.
I think a lot of people buy fleeces from Lords because Lords is an unexpectedly cold cricket ground.
And actually, it wasn't cold. I mean, Christmas Day was positively balmy to this year, I thought. I mean, you obviously just got back from somewhere hot. But
I went for a run at 9 a.m. down in Croydon. It was absolutely freezing. My hands were really?
I think the Spurs shop would have been closed on Christmas Day. I think they'd probably already purchased there.
It's a possibility, isn't it?
By that point.
Joseph says, it is a crime that they... his squad are going to play football again in 48 hours. It is against every rule of physiology and biology.
Well, I think Jurgen Klopp said similar.
And Guardiola's been moaning about it as well.
I feel for these managers of incredibly rich top-flight football teams having to go through this ordeal of playing games of football when people are on holiday and quite like to watch them. You know, Won't someone think of the managers and players?
Well, some of us who had to cover football yesterday didn't have a drink all day. You know, it's hard for us as well, the journalists. Mm-hmm. Well, nobody think of us, but, you know, you don't hear us moaning, do you? But unless you literally listen to us.
We used to play 3 games in 4 days over Christmas in this country, and someone should just show him a few fixture lists from a few years back and tell him he's got it lucky.
Isn't that like showing the pictures from those days as well?
That's like my dad talking about junior doctors only having to do 200-hour weeks and going, it wasn't as hard. I'd be interested to know how long it actually takes for a human body to recover.
I honestly couldn't care less. It's Christmas football. It's brilliant.
All right.
And it's the same for everyone.
Okay. So. And it's, you know, the richer you are, the bigger your squad, the more you can rotate. This is actually an advantage for the big clubs. That's the one thing I've got against it.
But...
So, in fact, what they should do... Yeah. What they should... Just to shut up these foreign people coming over here, telling us how to organise our game.
Yeah.
We invented this game. Yes. Let's not forget that.
Okay.
Is the middle of the Christmas fixtures, you should have to pour, I don't know, 1,000 gallons of water on the pitch. You should have to drive a tractor up and down the middle of it to
get a ball from
muddy.
The football museum in Preston.
Yeah, you should have to wear retro boots,
okay.
Heavy cotton shirts.
Yeah. What about army fatigues? Pretend it's the game, you know, the classic Christmas
game. We've
gone
too far now. That's just silly.
Sorry.
You should lower the temperature so it's like, you know, properly cold.
Okay.
Probably no hot water in the bath. Definitely no Lycra or deep heat or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should force our clubs to install undersoil freezing.
Yes.
Quarter of an orange at half time.
Should all the players have to brill cream their hair after the game?
Physio should have a little medical bags taken away and replaced by a bucket and a sponge.
Well, let's see. I mean, role at the Premier League has gone fine, isn't it? But I don't think we talk about it in too much detail. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Carlo Ancelotti's first game at Everton. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly live shows. January the 20th, Barry, me, you, Ellis, James, Nicky Bandini at the Salis Benny Theatre in Brighton. 27th, Liberty Hall, Dublin is me, you, Barry, Wilson, you and Barney Ronne. Tuesday, the 28th, I think we've got about 4 tickets left, is the two of us, Barry, Lars Iverton and Johnny Liu for his live show debut. March the 9th and 10th, me, you, Lars and one other. I think you, Barry, you're not down on the list yet, but I presume you're coming.
Which one's this, sorry?
Glasgow on the 9th and Edinburgh on the 10th.
Right.
Are you in for those?
I don't know, to
okay.
be honest.
Oh, we'll find out.
Maybe I am. Okay.
Yes, so come along to those, please. Right, to Goodison Park. Everton 1, Burnley 0. A win for Carlo Ancelotti in his first game in charge. Great header from Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Jonathan, did Carlo Ancelotti do anything different?
Well, he went back to the back three, which they last used against Liverpool in Marcus Silva's last game. When they appeared to have the better of a pretty bruising game. And then the goal is a brilliant goal. It's a great header from Calvert-Lewin. It's a great ball in from Sidibe. And just a beautiful header. There's a still picture of him where he's sort of not using his arms at all, so it's like he's a human cannonball.
Oh,
just sort of
perfect
leaning
couch in like.
Yeah.
Barry, you've been away since Ancelotti got the Everton job. Do you have any hot takes on what were the people of Goa saying about Carlo Ancelotti taking the Everton job?
Well, there seemed to be surprise. It's a funny one. I only watched, I think, 3 games while I was away, and one of them, unfortunately, was Arsenal-Everton, which is one of the worst games of football I've ever seen. Now, I know he wasn't in the dugout for that. He was just sort of watching from the director's box or whatever. People seem to be, just from what I've read, people seem to be surprised Everton have given him the job and saying that he's not the ideal candidate for Everton. But what do Everton fans want exactly? I'm not sure how high their expectations are, because I'm sure he'll do a pretty decent job at worst. You know, do they just want to be seventh again, or have they? Are they getting certain notions above their station, for want of a better phrase?
I think Everton fans are excited about Ancelotti and are annoyed that people like us are saying this is a weird appointment. We're suggesting Everton shouldn't have ambition, whereas I think most of the criticism has been Ancelotti normally goes to bigger clubs with better players and doesn't stay for very long, and Everton need...
But people are also saying that Ancelotti, for all that he has won, hasn't won as much as he should have when you consider the calibre of team he has managed, as if to undermine what he has achieved. And I can kind of see their point, but you know, three Champions Leagues is pretty good by any standards. And I think if I was an Everton fan, I'd be delighted he was there. But I'm just personally, I'm not sure what exactly it is that Everton fans are hoping to achieve. Do they realistically think they could get into the top four with Ancelotti? I can't see that happening myself, but you never know.
They need to spend a lot of money.
But they have spent
a
lot of money, but they've wasted an awful lot of money.
They just keep on buying sort of flimsy players who are on the way down from other clubs. So you've spent a huge amount. But
remember that summer they bought like 7,000 or 8,000 little nimble
tens,
number tens.
They're the Arsenal of the North.
Ben says, Carlo Ancelotti is the first Premier League manager to have appeared in Star Trek. He had a cameo in Star Trek Beyond. Which science fiction character would you like to see manage in the Premier League and why?
He could have given us some time.
We have time now to think about it.
That's not really my genre.
Being basic, Darth Vader would do excellently at Burnley, wouldn't he?
Why?
I don't know. I mean, I would.
Well, because he's got a bit of a sore throat.
I'm not saying Sean Dyche is like. Look, would you prefer to watch Burnley matches now or with Darth Vader as manager? Is my question.
I would like to see. If anyone, I would like to see Chewbacca manage a team just because when he gets animated, you know, making that shrieking noise from the technical area would be quite.
It would be nice if they had a good win. You know, he's managing, say, Bournemouth, and they've had a good win away at Arsenal, for example, and then that's the interview that Gary Lineker does on Match of the Day that they clearly pre-recorded 5 hours ago, and then they cut and Gary's there talking to Chewbacca.
Well, it would probably have to be a Han Solo Chewbacca, you know, number one,
that's
number two.
That's true.
But then Chewbacca, you know, did an Arteta and then went to manage on his own, it would be quite fun.
Yeah, I mean, R2-D2 C-3PO is a managerial duo. But I mean, I think I'd probably take Ripley out of Alien. Because she seemed to have a very good sort of sense of, under pressure, I think she makes right decisions.
No, that is true. Obviously, with the
maybe her with Stuart Ripley as the assistant,
or if you had a Dalek from Doctor Who as a manager, you know, his team talk, pre-match team talk would just be pretty predictable.
It's one word only, and presumably, you know, Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader were managing different teams. There'd be a lot based on whether there'd be a handshake before the game, wouldn't there? And
did anybody ever manage against their son before?
Gary Johnson and Lee Johnson, I believe.
Yeah.
And there wasn't as much press had it been Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. Anyway, let's go to Bournemouth now. Managed by Eddie Howe still, unfortunately. Bournemouth 1, Arsenal 1. No win for Arteta on his first game. He said after the match, "I'm not happy we have not won the game, but happy overall in terms of attitude, desire and commitment. It was better than I expected." Tim Stillman, Arsenal expert, said, "I was enthused by what we saw from Ozil yesterday. Not so much on an individual level, but it looked like Arsenal actually had a plan to get him the ball in space." Same question that I asked about Ancelotti. Did Arteta do anything different/interesting?
Well, there's more science fiction there, getting the ball to Ozil in space.
Did you see the training video from Arsenal?
Oh, it was brilliant, wasn't it?
It's just like, is that what they do? That looks really easy. Like,
did you
it's
see
really
it?
More to it than that.
It was just Arteta saying, when you get the ball, give it to a man in space. And you're like, is that all he's learnt from Pep? surely there's more to it.
He kicked the ball at somebody, he'd kick it back to him. He'd control and say, find a man in space, and he'd kick it to somebody else.
It's like The Simpsons, but more, wasn't it? That's what they've got. the bosses, you know, the bosses behind the camera going, Oh, shooties. We've got a dud here again. Bring back Unai. They'll have a plane with a banner, won't they? No, Simon, did you notice anything different from Arsenal? And, you know, a 1-1 draw at Bournemouth doesn't seem like, you know, the earth has changed.
I don't think the earth has changed. I think it's going to take some time, Arsenal. I think that everyone accepts that. But, you know, they came back from behind to win a point, and that's a small mercies. They're often the team that allows others to do that to them.
He hasn't had much time to do anything, and if that's where the bar is for training, it could be a while before he revolutionises anything. But his post-match comments sort of smack of, you know, you can encapsulate them in, I'm just glad we didn't lose. hopes.
Yeah. Look, they've won 1-14 in all competitions for Arsenal. Is that right? I mean, I wrote that, but is that really right?
Yeah, I 1-13 is in my head, but that might have been before yesterday. It's definitely very close to being that, if it's not that.
They've won the same amount of games as Brighton, Bournemouth, West Ham and Villa. So that's where they are, right? Crystal Palace 2, West Ham 1. Pretty average Premier League game. A couple of reasonable goals from Snodgrass and Kiarte. A couple of decent chances for each side. And then Jordan Ayew picked it up on the touchline. Sort of double dragged back, beat another two men, and then dinked it over Roberto. Is this the most unexpected goal of the season contender ever, Barry?
Probably. I don't rate Jordan Ayew at all. I think his attitude stinks. I don't think he scores enough. And I was really shocked. But, you know,
he's had a better season than that.
He has this season, but, you know, he owes Crystal Palace, definitely. And I think Johnson said he always plays well for Ghana, but...
No. His brother plays very well
Andre,
for Ghana.
Oh, it's Andre, right.
Sorry. I'm pretty much with you with Jordan, that I think in terms of talent-to-brain ratio, he's pretty much the worst player in the history of football. But he does have that talent, and every now and again... I mean,
are you the opposite of the spectrum?
I mean, on a football pitch, but arguably, given just how bad I am at football, yeah.
Your brain to talent ratio is really woeful.
I remember you, Max, saying, talking about two of you played in a media game.
I did, yes.
Two of our esteemed colleagues, I won't name them, shame them, but one of them has recently become a high-profile signing for the Guardian. And you were absolutely astounded how two people who seem to know so much about football could be so bad at playing it.
I mean, in fairness to Miguel, he had a very heavy night.
They were both very hungover. I suppose the point was I suddenly turned into sort of a professional footballer saying, I've played the game, son. So you listen to me. I was like, there's a different level of it. Now I understand when Ray Houghton screams it. I've played the game.
I've told you Jeff Hurst's comment to me after the England media team beat the Portugal media team on penalty after a 4-4 draw in 2004.
No.
I walked off the pitch absolutely. I literally vomited because I'd run so much. It was baking heat in Lisbon. I was playing right back, worst player on the pitch. Tony Gale played centre half, which helped. And as I walked off, Jeff Hurst pat me on the shoulder and went, well done, son. For somebody who really can't play football, I thought he did all right.
Simon, can we just give Jordan Ayew some credit?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It was absolutely gorgeous, that goal. But you do a 360 turn on the edge of the area, and that is basically, you know, 90% of the time someone does a 360, that is show over, right? They do that, they lose the ball or they get rid of it immediately afterwards. That's the end of the show. But that was just the opening act. He then had like a further gorgeous touch to ghost past the last couple of defenders and still had the presence of mind to dink it over the goalkeeper.
Roberto doing very much Roberto by lying down.
Yeah, there was that.
I don't think Conor Wickham is getting enough credit for giving the ball to Ayew in the first place.
Oh, is this the assist a bit like
Hector Enrique?
Hector Enrique for Maradona and Steve Lomas claiming an assist for that Georgie Klinkladze goal. In fact, Steve Lomas also says he did the overlapping run, which allowed Trevor Sinclair the space to cross it for that Di Canio volley.
Well, I think to be fair, Wickham needs all the, you know, credit and good vibes he can get at the moment.
Mark Noble and Valbuena had a big row, didn't they? That was quite fun. Noble looked very... I mean, Noble's just quite a calm, you know, important part of that. Just quite a calm character. After seeing that row on Match of the Day, Danny Murphy decided that that's the end for Pellegrini. I don't, not specifically that row. I don't know if you...
Well, I think the highlight of this game was... on Christmas Day, Michel Antonio crashing his Lamborghini into someone's house in Balham, South London.
While dressed as a smoker.
I forgot that important detail. And apparently, like, the car is a write-off, but he wasn't hurt, mercifully. He was able to play the next day, but he didn't even apologise to the owner of the house in question.
It was a bin store outside the house rather than the house.
Yeah, but
I mean, it doesn't make it much better.
He demolished it.
I mean, you sort of think, I reckon if I accidentally knocked a milk bottle and smashed it on someone's drive, I might knock on the door and say, I'm really, really sorry. If you tip over a Lamborghini while dressed as a snowman, the least you could do is at least leave a note. Don't you think? But, sorry about this. What do you think's going to happen to the Lamborghini?
There's Nightingale Lane as well. Those houses wouldn't be cheap. Cracking pub on Nightingale Lane, called the Nightingale.
Do you think the owners just... Did he just hope maybe if he just rearranged the bins that they wouldn't notice there was an upturned Lamborghini?
On Christmas Day, I actually considered going up to the Nightingale to see if it was open for a couple of pints, and didn't bother because it's a bit far to go for no booze. Hmm. But yeah, that could have been quite the scoop.
Couldn't it?
If I'd be walking along and a distressed Michael Antonio dressed as a snowman was clambering out of a written-off Lamborghini.
Seriously, on Christmas Day, when you spent the morning in Wetherspoons, are you really going to be asked to get your phone out your pocket and ring the desk? Even if you've seen Michael Antonio post-car crash dressed as a snowman.
I think that would be enough to prompt me to call in.
Yeah, we haven't heard Mikhail's side of the story, so we look forward.
Absolutely.
Just in terms of Pellegrini's future, Jacob was saying this morning that he thinks they've got Leicester and then Bournemouth next two, and he thinks if there's no improvement, then that'll be it.
But when players are arguing like that on the pitch, that is an advanced symptom of a disease-riddled footballing corpse, I think.
Have you ever driven dressed as a bear?
No, I walked as a bear. Yeah.
You didn't end up upturned in someone's garden. Of the people I'm looking at, there's one suspect for who's ended up upturned in someone's garden in my mind. But anyway, Aston Villa 1, Norwich 0. Jack Grealish said it felt like they'd won a cup as they beat Norwich to end their four-match losing streak. Norwich are now 6 points adrift of safety, Villa 1 point off that. And after Wolves for Norwich, another game where Norwich could and should have got something out of the game, probably 3 points.
I thought they should have won this, but
it was incredible goal line clearance from Douglas Luiz from Alex Tetti. Tom Heaton made some good saves as well, either side of Villa's goal.
Yeah, I saw Jake Humphrey tweeting that, you know, he's an Norwich fan, obviously, and he was saying he thinks the club is in a really good place, even if that place is bottom of the Premier League, and quite a few Norwich fans, you know, took him to task and were very shouty and angry and we need to spend money and blah blah blah, but I think it seems to be a very well run club, and I know they didn't spend top of the halfpenny over the summer. I'd be interested to see what they do in January. Will they try and throw money at the problem, or will they just keep going as they are? I can still see them staying up, but it'll be hard.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting. There don't appear to be any really rubbish teams in the Premier League this year.
Is it not just the case that there's far more rubbish teams than even usual? Like, there's usually 10 rubbish teams in the Premier League. This year, I think there's more.
Well, it depends how you define rubbish. I mean, there's no team in the Premier League who I don't enjoy watching at the minute. All of them have got something. And that's pretty unusual. And that's why I keep thinking Arsenal might get dragged into it, which would be very, very funny.
I was looking today at a forecast table based on the last 8 games, which is a reasonable sample size. And on that table, Watford was staying up with 33 points, and there were like 6 or 7 teams with well under 40 points. Which, and it's the same as the stat about Chelsea being close to the bottom than the top. I mean, Liverpool are outliers, but otherwise, it's a really decent competitive league this year. That's what that's telling you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Sheffield United 1, Watford 1. De La Feo opening the scoring with a nice side foot pass finish. Norwood equalising from the penalty spot. Ben Foster was the difference in this game.
Yeah, two great saves. Really great saves.
He's a good player and a nice bloke. Yeah, and a good cook.
Yes.
He is, yes. Not that he's ever cooked me anything. I'm only going off his word, but...
He used to be a chef at Café Rouge, didn't he, in Leamington Spa, I think.
Is that so?
I believe that was his job before he was signed by Stoke.
It does seem that Nigel Pearson has done quite a lot in a short space of time, doesn't it?
It does. I did think yesterday Watford were surprisingly passive. You know, it's a good point in the end at Sheffield United. Sheffield didn't look at their peak at all. Didn't have that many attacking moments, but obviously should have scored another couple of goals all the same. So I guess a lucky point for Watford. Aston Villa next for them. Villa run of form is, you know, their run of fixtures rather. They played Southampton and lost quite badly, and then Norwich yesterday, and then Watford on the 28th. just three totally crucial fixtures one after the other. They couldn't really afford to have lost yesterday to Norwich, which they could well have done.
Nick Harris has tweeted a table of best value so far this Premier League season in points return per pound spent per player on wages in the Premier League. Do anyone like to guess who's bottom of the table?
Manchester United?
Yeah, £109,386 per player per point. Top of the league?
Sheffield United.
£12,552 per player per point. And actually, they are three times less than any other side. Wolves, Burnley, Norwich, Newcastle, Leicester, Brighton, Bournemouth, Liverpool, Villa are your top 10. But quite extraordinary when you think how much money there is and what you actually get for it in football. The bottom three, Everton, Arsenal and Manchester United. I've retweeted that. It's interesting. Canary Mark says, do you think the Amazon way is the way ahead? In the UK, Amazon had their second run out, putting every game on. Personally, I loved it. Watching my team live lose to Villa was a joy as part of watching four games in a row while eating turkey leftovers really pissed off my family, he says.
Well, I watched four games yesterday, which is... my head was spinning by the end of it.
Yeah, there's a vaguely sort of hallucinatory effect. Because I then had Leeds v Preston on, which was the same time as the United-Newcastle game. Mm-hmm. And I'd obviously got up and watched the cricket at 8. Mm-hmm. So...
I think everyone should be able to watch whichever game they please, and they should all be available. But I don't think adding further subscriptions is the way forward.
I don't know if I agree.
People... Well,
I know
I can afford BT and Sky, but a lot of people can't afford any of them. Mm. And the opportunities to watch live football are getting... It's just getting tougher and tougher for people who don't have the means to do so. And I have a neighbour I do some shopping for sometimes. He's West Indian, elderly West Indian gentleman. He loves cricket. He never gets to see any because he can't afford Sky, you know, and... I'm not having a go at Sky or BT or anyone in particular, but it's getting ridiculous the amount of different subscriptions you have to take out.
There are enough family arguments on Boxing Day already without presenting people. I mean, you're basically throwing a bomb with a lit fuse into the living room and saying, okay, you know, there's a live match at 12:30, there's six live matches at 3, and then a match at 5:30 and a match at 8, and what are you going to do about it? And basically, football fans are going to say, okay, I'll watch all of that, and all their families are going to say, well, you can... not healthy. It's not a good time.
The debate about free-to-air is you know, it's happened in other sports, you know, cricket specifically, and when the World Cup final was on free-to-air, and there's a big debate about it, and have they lost a generation by not having any test cricket on free-to-air? Because football is much bigger, do you think... Is that even conceivably ever going to be an issue, right, for clubs or for any of us, that people aren't going to stop watching it? That's the issue, right? It'd be great.
An issue for the sport.
For the sport, yeah.
Of football. Mm.
Well, the thing where I feel sympathy with cricket is that the BBC clearly lost patience with cricket, and you know, went to Channel 4 first, but I'm not convinced that there's a free-to-air channel would welcome test cricket back. Mm. And yeah, it's very easy to hammer Sky, but Sky were the company who showed all the overseas games way before anybody else showed any interest in it. So I don't think it's as easy as you shouldn't sell out to this sort of rapacious company. Football, as you say, is different. And I think the bigger issue, I mean, this is not really answering your question, but the bigger issue is collective bargaining has to remain. Mm. You have to have the league bargaining as one, and that money's got to be, not necessarily divided equally, but there has to be at least some kind of substitute to the bottom of the league. Otherwise, the rich are going to get even richer, and the poor even poorer. Or, well, not poor, but not as rich.
I also think younger generations, and even my own attention span, is just getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And people don't have the inclination or patience to sit down and watch a football match that takes 2 hours when they know they can just see... snipped highlights on Twitter or catch a YouTube package 2 minutes long afterwards.
Well, actually, it took me to write a bit about the last Amazon thing to realise how I was consuming football now, which was having a game on the laptop, having my other my wife's laptop open with Twitter so I could have a polite conversation about anti-Semitism. Someone had told me that Ellis James was narrating a documentary about farmyards.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So I was watching him talk about bees. Oh, you know, you just, and then I'm texting Ellis to say what he's telling me. So I'm not actually spending any time. I mean, that's not just a comment on how you people or I consume football. It's how you sort of consume life, I guess. But actually, I've consciously tried since then to, when I'm watching football, to just watch football and not feel the need to tweet about it or see what other people are saying about it.
I mean, maybe it is an attention span issue, I'm not sure, but I think there probably is plenty of evidence to suggest attention spans have got shorter. But also, when football was on telly when we were kids, it was an event.
Yeah.
So you watched it because there wouldn't be another game coming on 10 minutes later.
Which is also another reason why, actually, maybe it's just our generation, and it'd be different for people who liked watching whatever game they could yesterday, was if you can watch all of it, it's less special that you can watch it. So when, for example, when I was young and I wanted to watch Tottenham more than anyone else, then I was excited when they were on because it didn't happen very much.
All men yell at cloud.
Tonight's Wolves against City, 7:45 kickoff. Football League and the Championship, top two both had to settle for 1-1 draws. West Brom and Leeds were held by Barnsley and Preston, respectively. Brentford moved up to third.
That last 10 minutes when Preston equalised were brilliant to watch.
Really?
They were like, just relentless. It was fantastic. You saw the fitness that Bielsa brings to a side before they
burn out.
the sort of 4 or 5 minutes before the goal must have, for Preston fans, must have felt like an hour, because it was just over and over again, balls at the bottom. I mean, actually, a lot of the crossing was pretty poor, but somehow Leeds always collected on the other side and put it back across. And okay, the goal eventually was a huge deflection, but they totally deserved it. Sorry, and Preston had played very well the first hour or so.
Brentford moved up to third after they beat Swansea 3-1 at Griffin Park. At the other end of the table, Stoke scored proper Stoke goals in the 93rd and 97th minute to beat Sheffield Wednesday 3-2. Proper kitchen sink stuff, says producer Sammy. In League One, two defeats in a row for leaders Wickham. This time they lost 2-0 away at Portsmouth. Second place Ipswich also dropped points. They drew 0-0 at home to Gillingham. Ipswich manager Paul Lambert's post-match press conference transcript is amusing reading if you have, I presume, a lot of time on your hands. He's just saying, I'll go. If you want me to go, I'll go. And there the journalists are saying, no, we don't want to. Oh, I'll go. I will.
I thought Ipswich were doing quite well.
Yeah, so did I. They are.
Yeah, I saw Nick Ames complaining about the quality that the band dropped off. I think he's just woken up with the fact of in League One now.
Do you think that they want Mick McCarthy back?
I reckon they're all pining for me.
They're now just a reply to @B Glendenning, Ipswich fans. They're now just 4 points separating Ipswich in second and Blackpool in tenth. In League Two, Cambridge narrowly lost 4-0 away to leaders Swindon. Owen Dial scored for the 11th consecutive game, only the second player alongside Jamie Vardy to do that this century in the top four divisions. Second place Exeter also picked up maximum points. Another 1-0 win for them over Newport. Gwilym says, can winter breaks be made optional? Cardiff City are tawdry to watch. The remainder of the season will be mid-table. Don't be deceived by our position, purgatory. I'd happily sacrifice some points for the excitement of a relegation battle. I like the idea of a team just saying, we're out for the next five. And Andy Dawson from Atletico Mints, amongst other things, says, today's 0-0 draw, a home draw with Bolton, was undoubtedly the lowest point in the entire history of Sunderland. We are sleepwalking towards relegation with a club owned by and managed by a pair of inept bullshitting clowns. Change needs to happen now.
Things haven't gone well for Phil Parkinson, that's fair to say. Two wins in 13 or 14 games. Yeah, something like that. The football's been pretty ropey. He seems to have fallen out with the only good player Sunderland have in Aidan McGeady. He's talking about pace and muscle, which, you know, if you've seen the Sunderland squad. Actually, it doesn't matter what your plan is, this is not a good Sunderland squad. There's issues with the ownership. That Charlie Methven has resigned either because he's got a kid due in the new year, is his story. There are various other stories. He appeared to say at a fans' meeting that Northerners couldn't do business, which probably when you're trying to run a Northern club isn't a great thing to say. Stuart Donald, who's actually the majority shareholder, I think he wanted to sell up in the summer and wasn't able to do so. So we've got this £10 million loan from Dell, well, an American consortium including Dell, which everybody got very excited by, because had they actually taken over the club, Sunderland would have become very, very rich. £10 million obviously didn't go that far. It's pretty bleak.
10 points above the relegation zone. Sunderland, obviously, a number of clubs in real trouble in League One.
Yeah, it should be said, Sunderland are very fortunate that Bury have gone and Bolton start on -25, sure, whatever it was.
Fitbar Corner, Barry. Welcome back for Fitbar.
Thank you.
That's okay. We have missed it tremendously.
Oh, did you not have a replacement feedback corner?
We just didn't think anyone could do it justice.
No, well, I put a lot of work into it, as you know. The big game on Boxing Day. I always get stick, by the way, for referring to it as Boxing Day, because in Ireland it's Stephen's Day.
Oh,
so
fine.
I would like to apologise to our Irish audience for adapting the... You know, in this anglicisation, but I've been taking the soup for a long time now. It's
would you like to apologise to our Scottish listeners generally?
So the Edinburgh Derby was played at Tynecastle yesterday, and Hibs beat Hearts 2-0, leaving Hearts, who should realistically be third, fourth in the table, a rock bottom. And Hearts boss Daniel Stendel, who was manager of Barnsley, he was criticised for going home to Germany on personal business following their game last weekend, and he left it with his assistant Andy Kirk to prepare the team for the derby. And they were also got criticism because they were given Christmas Day off, didn't do any training, and asked why he went home to Germany ahead of this very important game. Stendel said, "I cannot and would not explain. It was long agreed before I signed here. I know it's a difficult situation, but when you see the game, it was not the reason we did not win." So he's under pressure already, despite not having been in position very long. Celtic won their 11th in a row with a 2-1 win over St Mirren, and Alfredo Morelos came off the bench to score a winner for Rangers against Kilmarnock. Celtic remain 5 clear of Rangers, who have played one game fewer, and they meet on Sunday in the derby.
Barry Glendenning, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that's the end of part two. Part three will be quite short. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Simon, it looked like you wanted to say something.
Well, just... I could probably now answer the one about science fiction characters if you wanted to.
Oh, yes, go on then.
Well, so Zaffod Beeblebrox, are you a Hitchhiker's Guide person?
Not enough to know what that was.
Well, so Zaffod Beeblebrox is the president of the galaxy or whatever he is. He's the two-headed character who steals the spaceship run by an infinite improbability drive, as football does seem to be sometimes as well. He could fit in. I was also thinking about Minority Report, which is a Philip K. Dick short story originally. And some kind of prescient half-dormant soothsayer types. If you know the story, I've seen the film. Anyway, there are some people who have visions of goals before they're scored and allow managers...
very much like Paul Merson, if you had Soccer Saturday on yesterday with the Amazon feeds.
Yeah, he was like Minority Report. Yeah, just print out a little thing saying they're going to score from this corner unless you do that, and then you can...
Oh, and swipe it away. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, Premier League fixtures, which are tomorrow, if you're listening on the day before tomorrow.
and on Sunday, if you're not. Unless Sunday is tomorrow.
It's not a gripping set of fixtures, I guess. Brighton, Bournemouth, Newcastle, Everton, Southampton, Palace, Watford, Villa, Norwich, Spurs, West Ham, Leicester, Burnley, Manchester United. That is Saturday's serving for you. Arsenal, Chelsea. Could be fun, couldn't it? Arteta's first home game. See what Super Frank does. Better away from home. The fans will want Arsenal to have the ball. Could be a stunning win. And once again, the narrative will turn against Jonathan Wilson. Wolves are the latest team to lose to Liverpool. Though they could. I mean, if anyone's going to upset them. Wolves won at City, didn't they? They've sort of got that in their locker.
They've got City... today and Liverpool on Sunday.
Yeah, they have the shortest gap of any team between fixtures at
four and three quarter hours.
I think that fixture
computer's not been very kind to them this particular 2-day period.
Keeps on giving them games on a Thursday as well. It's a nightmare.
City play Sheffield United at 6 o'clock on Sunday. Alan Pardew. Vaughan says, mate, surely you now can't deny the man, the myth, the legend that is Alan Pardew from a mention on the award-nominated podcast that is Football Weekly. Only 16 points to make up in order for Europa League qualification.
I mean, it's not a surprise to see Alan Pardew appearing at The Hague. I just didn't think he'd be managing a football club.
He's been appointed as head coach of ADO Den Haag. 58-year-old's been out of work since being sacked by West Brom in 2018. Will now be tasked with keeping them in the top flight. They're called the Storks. He takes Chris Powell with him as his assistant, although Powell will continue his role as a coach with the England setup. They're out without a win since the 26th of October. His first game in the dugout will be at home to bottom side RKC Waalwijk.
Waalwijk
on the 19th of January. Zlatan is in talks with a return to AC Milan, apparently. It's understood other clubs are interested in him. 38. He's a free agent after LA Galaxy.
I went to Waalwijk once.
Did you?
Yeah, I saw them get beat 6-1 by PSV. Right. And Ian Robin, I think he was 19 at the time, absolutely destroyed this lumbering left back for Waalwijk, who...
Did he play... He cut him from the right, did he?
He was Khalid Boulouris.
Anyway, back to Zlatan. He spent two seasons at Milan, 2010. Scored 42 in 61 league outings, so that could be interesting. Mario Mandzukic has joined Qatari side Al Duhail after 4.5 years at Juventus. Questions for the pod before we finish. Sal says, so Wilson likes Boomer wine. This is the wine that Wilson served.
Boomer wine? What does that mean?
I don't know. He said, I expected a more progressive choice from a progressive man. Maybe Jura, Savoy, Etna, Alto Adige. I don't know any of these. What?
You're the wine buff, not me.
Yeah, what do you want to know about those wines?
I've no idea. What did you bring in on the pod, last pod?
It was a 2015 Medoc.
Yeah, it was really good.
It was very nice.
Yeah, very smooth. And then Jonathan and I went
Chateau Siguenou.
The bottle we had in Franco Manca afterwards was not as good.
No, it was a lot cheaper, to be fair.
It was a lot cheaper.
Tasted it.
Reese says, given he's now spiritually enlightened, what advice can Barry give to us all for 2020?
Don't paint elephants with vegetable oil because people on Twitter get very judgy about it.
Do you wish you just batted it to death with a baseball bat?
No, I had a very nice time with that elephant. We spent 2.5 quality hours together.
Oh, a boomer. It's not a type of wine. It's from the Urban Dictionary, a person from the baby boomer generation, or really anyone who's older than the person using the word, usually used if said person is being annoying about a younger generation. Seems slightly harsh, doesn't it?
Brought in some wine for people to share.
Finally, Vanuatu says, I started listening to this podcast in January. I've spent more time listening to Barry, Max and everyone else than my parents. Can I get any assurances that the pod will make all the parenting I'm missing worth it in 2020? Thank you for a great year. Those that listen on Spotify, they get a kind of review of what they've listened to. And as far as I could make out, he spent this year, he spent 18,579 minutes listening to this podcast. I don't even know if we've made that many minutes.
18,000 minutes.
Well, maybe he's gone into the back catalogue.
It's possible.
So that's 300 hours.
Still got a lot more to go.
Maybe that was more than just... Maybe that's podcast in total. So, but on his screen...
So 300 hours. If we do two a week, that's roughly 100 hours over the year.
Mm-hmm.
He listened to 3 years' worth of podcasts in a year.
Maybe he's just... on his screen, it had... It sort of has the one you listen to the most as a big picture, and then it has smaller squares behind it of all the podcasts, and all of his squares were Guardian Football Weekly.
Maybe he has to listen to it multiple times to work out what Barry's saying.
Yeah, possible. Yeah. Or to understand it at all.
Well, you see, Ellis and John Robbins, their Radio X podcast, they had listeners who they referred to as retro oneers, who were late to the party but then went back and listened to them all from the very start. So I like to think that this chap is, or girl is, listening to me, Jimbo, Sean Ingle.
That's the problem with sequels, isn't it? If you haven't seen them all, then like, you're not going to understand it.
Pontificating about the 2010 World Cup.
Yeah, there you go. Well, whichever one you're listening to, thanks for that. And is this our last one before New Year? We've got another one. When do I say Happy New Year? Next pod? It's very tiring, doesn't it?
Especially when you're so insincere.
No, genuinely, thank you for listening to this. We all appreciate it. Yes. Barry, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Lovely to have you back.
Thanks.
Jonathan, thank you.
Cheers, thank you.
Simon, thank you.
Pleasure.
We'll be back soon.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
RKC Waalwijk.
Waalwijk.
Thank you.